Welcome to the Uncovered Podcast, where we take a deeper look into the ideas, companies, and entrepreneurs that are creating the future and uncover the stories you haven't heard. Uncovered is presented by PJC, an early stage venture capital firm committed to supporting the next generation of entrepreneurs.
We're here with season two of the Uncovered Podcast, where we're exploring the world of corporate development. We're here with Charlie Birkmeyer at Culligan International, and I'm here with my co-host, Rob May.
Hi, everybody.
And we're going to dive in and learn a little bit more about Charlie and the world of corporate development at Culligan International. How are you doing today, Charlie?
Well, thanks, Matt. Nice to speak with you today.
Yeah, it's great to have you on. You know, we like to kick off each episode with learning a little bit more about, you know, the background of the people that are going to talk to us a little bit about corporate development. So it seems like you've had an awesome career. We'd love to learn a little bit more about how you got to Culligan and the things that, you know, excite you in the world.
Sure. Yeah. I'll try not to bore your listeners with a shaggy dog, but been in private equity of a former fashion or principal investing for about a decade. Came at it from an unusual route. Me and a colleague from business school put together a search fund, a little buyout vehicle, and ended up buying a data security company that you'd have to try hard to screw it up at the time that we bought. And we try as we might, we were successful. And that pushed me in this direction and did some time at a small buyout fund, private equity buyout fund in downtown Boston, lower middle market group. And then ultimately connected with the folks at Advent who had just acquired Culligan and needed an M&A team, corp dev team to help pursue their strategy.
So can you tell us a little bit about Culligan? You're really unique in the sense that, you know, it's not a, you know, a lot of the corporate development folks that we have on this podcast are, you know, fully tech, come from tech backgrounds. I would love to hear a little bit more about Culligan and what M&A is like in a somewhat non-tech environment.
Yeah, sure. Frankly, it's probably quite a bit less glamorous. A lot of effort trying to just build out distribution and connect with small business owners that probably have not enjoyed the potentially meteoric success that some of the technology companies might enjoy. A lot of sort of boots on the ground work, and Culligan has launched into a fairly programmatic M&A effort from, you know, a corporate development standpoint to try and expand its geographic coverage and its product suite. So a ton of dialogue, a ton of conversations with folks who have built businesses over 30 years, have a tremendous amount of sort of tribal institutional knowledge, but might not be, you know, Silicon Valley cut in terms of, you know, deep pedigree and you know, having experienced outrageous success.
And so, Charlie, how do you think about, you know, when we talk to these different groups, you mentioned that Culligan's a little bit programmatic. And so how does your workflow break down into, you know, how much time do you spend sort of like hunting? Like you know, you talk to other executives in the business and you guys form a plan, and then your job is to go out and find and execute on, you know, acquisitions that sort of fulfill that plan. And how much of it is sort of fielding inbound where people reach out to you, whether it's investment bankers or entrepreneurs or other people like that. And then you sort of triage what comes in and decide, you know, what to do with it. Which way are you more likely to work, or is it a mixture of both? And if so, what's the mix like?
Yeah, it's a great question, Rob. I think I've certainly spoken with colleagues who have a really strong inbound deal flow and respond primarily to that. Culligan, we probably receive, you know, in terms of deals that we act on, maybe of the 46 deals that we've closed that we would consider, you know, proper deals, so to speak, as opposed to really small dealer add-ons and so forth, I would say maybe tops 10% of them were banked. Now, some of those have been really big, but we've been in dialogue with those companies for years antecedent to them having been brought to formal process. So, you know, obviously the upshot of that is that we do quite a bit of business development, origination work, and frankly, that's my primary role for the company. You know, it's at the end of the day, my work is centered around understanding what the corporate executives at Culligan and what our private equity sponsor are driving at on a broad strategic basis, and knowing the landscape of businesses out there, frankly, on a global basis, although we tend to focus on, you know, more fully developed economies. But knowing what's out there, what's available, whether it be technology, product, distribution, manufacturing, and being able to articulate what, you know, what's actionable, what's not, and get those folks involved. And then, you know, from there, there's a team, a pretty substantial team at this point, 7 folks, focused on the M&A execution, due diligence, sort of the standard functions that you might associate with a corp dev team.
Charlie, you're PE backed, which is, you know, a little bit different than some of the other corp dev folks that we've chatted with before. How much of the acquisitions are coming directly off of your balance sheet versus going back to your private equity sponsors to raise additional capital in order to execute an acquisition?
Yeah, I need to be a little bit delicate, of course, in responding to the question, but I think, you know, I can be fair to all parties and say that a lot of our acquisition has been cash flow funded, but our private equity partners and debt partners have supported some of the bigger ones. You know, we may have seen, or it was announced, Culligan acquired Quench as part of the Aqua Venture Holdings acquisition, closing in late March. It was a $1 billion transaction, so that one didn't come off the balance sheet.
Awesome. Very cool.
Interesting. And in tech, we talk a lot about all the reasons that deals fall apart. And sometimes they fall apart. Tech companies do a lot of snooping in the sense of, hey, you know, they'll talk to a company, they'll even say, maybe we're interested in acquiring you guys. And, you know, probably 7 out of 10 times it doesn't actually happen. And then a lot of times it falls apart because tech valuations, as you know, can be a little crazy sometimes, and founders sometimes have different expectations. You know, do you see a similar thing, you know, in your world, in the sense of, like, do a lot of deals fall apart? And I don't mean sort of like post LOI deals, but I mean, you know, when you initially think you have an agreement, do things fall apart? And if so, is it valuation driven? Is it something that you find in diligence, or what are some of the common causes?
Yeah, you know, I would love to put out there I don't know how to frame it best, but without sounding immodest or self-serving, I feel fortunate to be part of a company that has a truly sterling reputation for getting deals done that they get involved in. And you certainly caveated away from deals under LOI. So I'll leave that be. But even, you know, I think all of the team that I'm on and the executives that I work with think really heavily about sort of the value of our word when we get engaged in a dialogue. And if there's sort of a handshake understanding that we're moving forward on a given basis, we hope to move forward on it in earnest. But nevertheless, to your point, things come up. And so I don't, you know, I actually just completed an exercise view on our global pipeline, which is substantial because the companies that we have acquired are now under, you know, engaging in their own M&A efforts. So I have some sense of what makes them, what doesn't, but a lot of noise in those numbers. You know, I think by the time we get to a point of saying, hey, you know, we're agreed on price, let's draft up the LOI, or we're agreed in principle, we're heading forward, we probably have a 40% success rate. But there is definitely always that chasm, I think, inherent to the sale and purchase of a business between the way an optimistic entrepreneur who necessarily needs to be optimistic to succeed views the value of a company, considering the effort that he or she has put into it and what he sees on the horizon, and with the need to earn a return and discount for uncertainties and all the rest on the buy side.
Interesting. And so how do you think about the types of companies you acquire? You know, most of the companies that we deal with are software companies, but there's been a resurgence in the last few years, partially because of software and some tool sets that have arisen. There's been a resurgence in, you know, biotech and, you know, nanochemistry and materials science and a lot of your more hard sciences as software has and innovation and tech entrepreneurship has started to permeate those things. We're seeing a lot more companies in that space, you know. And so I'm just curious, like, when you look at, you know, when you look at your time at Culligan and the kinds of companies that you've been acquiring and the kinds that you, have there been changes in terms of what you see? Is there innovation related to tech and water that you see? And if so, like, what types of innovation are? Is it chemistry? Is it robotics? You know, what's going on in the industry from your perspective?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And, you know, frankly, I didn't give the listeners enough of a context at the front end to really fathom the sort of the nature of the changes, and maybe they'll indulge. Culligan is really providing water filtration and purification either at the point of entry or the point of use in the home. And that can take the form of, say, reverse osmosis or a carbon block filter, other forms and fashions thereof, and then also softening, as I mentioned at the outset, taking out salts that have adverse effects on household appliances and washing of things, so to speak, and substituting them for a different salt or finding a way to, you know, kind of eliminate their effects. And then doing similar type processes at restaurants and hotels and on the go and all the rest of it. And so, as you might imagine, many of the processes and many of the products, frankly, and services in that space are fully mature. And a lot of there are a lot of innovations in terms of models to market and business, you know, business models and approaches. But historically, it's been an industry of slow technological progress. That being said, in these times, particularly, and we can talk about that later if it's interesting, but we have seen a shift, and we ourselves have shifted towards interest in technologies that have come to the fore around improving, for example, the rejection rate on reverse osmosis. So RO throws away a bunch of water. There are techniques to, in exchange for pure water, it throws away wastewater to get pure water. There are techniques and technologies emerging to really improve that from an environmental and wastewater standpoint. Softening, there have been a lot of technologies that have come to the fore. Not a lot. There have been a handful of technologies that have started to mature to eliminate the use of salt, so to speak. Big bags of salt are the way that softeners work today in the softening process, which would have great advantages for the customers and some for the environment. And then to your point, we've seen some really interesting nanotechnology coatings that are involved in the cooling process, and in some cases, the filtration process being applied to filter substrates that can really bring, you know, the kinds of changes that I think people are accustomed to seeing in technology type plays, where it's a 40% improvement in the energy required to chill water or to get condensed water from a water generator.
Charlie, what types of companies and sizes are you buying? So, like, you think about acquisitions. I mean, they're all different sizes. What are you thinking of from a sizing standpoint? And then how do you think about, you know, multiples? Are there, you know, is there one area that you're looking and you kind of like have tried and true public comps to kind of like value these companies? Or are you basing the acquisitions off of like multiple expansion following an acquisition? Like, how are you thinking about some of these things? I'm sure the multiples are very different than tech. And so would love to just understand a little bit about acquisition sizes and multiples and kind of what you see when you're looking at businesses, as opposed to some of the corporate development folks that are looking at tech businesses.
Yeah, sure. So the size of the, you know, the range is wide, but the distribution is a little bit easier to get a handle on. So, you know, we literally have done, excluded from the 46 I mentioned, we've done bought books of business that are, you know, $100,000 in scale. But we've, in terms of the what we would consider to be tuck-in business, we've done, you know, revenue in the $1 million range to several $100 million, and enterprise values, you know, co-commitment with those numbers. In terms of valuation, you know, when I think about tech multiples and what we're looking at, you know, always tricky to kind of put a thumb on it. And I'm not necessarily speaking on behalf of Culligan or how we'd price a deal, but just in terms of the industry and the market and the way things trade, if one were to consider a sub $20 million in revenue point of use filtration cooler business with a book of rental business that they own, that's not sort of leased or factored out, that's got some growth, you know, call it sub 10% a year growth, but nevertheless growing. And if you're considering the acquisition of the going concern versus buying the contracts and effectively laying off all the staff and monetizing those contracts across your own infrastructure, which you might occasionally actually see a multiple of revenue and sometimes not software style, but you'd see, you know, 3-4 times potentially on a really attractive cooler base. But setting that aside, you know, a point of use cooler filtration business, rental business might trade for 7-9 times. And then if the coolers aren't owned, you know, you'd start looking at EBITDA less CapEx to deal with the cost of growing the business and so forth. But different ball of wax, I think, than you'd see in the software industry, to be sure.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting for, you know, our listeners to hear, just because most tech companies, as you know, VCs, we think a lot about revenue multiple. I mean, we're not talking about EBITDA very frequently because there usually isn't much this early. And so we're obviously doing pre-seed and seed mostly. And so if there is any revenue, it's valuing companies on, especially, you know, as they continue to grow, it's still revenue-based for a very, very long time. So it's interesting to kind of like show that delineation between the types of businesses you're buying versus the types of businesses we're investing in, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah. And I think it's been interesting at Culligan because as we have moved into, and this has been a process over 18 months anyway, into examining technologies in the water space, of course, we're grappling with and trying to get familiar with investments that are closer to what's near and dear to your, you know, to you and your audience. And frankly, it's uncharted ground for us. And so it takes heavy lifting on our team's part because we know how to value the sort of traditional businesses in our industry, obviously pretty well. But once we get into no revenue or tiny revenue and companies that have received tremendous investment, it's a whole different ballgame, as I'm sure you can articulate.
And so, Charlie, do you have similar challenges when you acquire a company that sometimes large tech acquirers have where do you have issues with team retention or, you know, founder and executive team retention? Or, you know, you mentioned like buying a book of business. Like, are you doing a lot of acquisitions where it doesn't matter if the team stays around? And if so, do you use similar, do you use stock options? Do you use, you know, earnouts and cash payments and those similar types of tools to retain people?
Another great question. Yeah, Rob, we now kind of run the gamut. Historically, for the first few years of Advent's ownership, we were really just focused on full retention. You know, we really were expanding, and I think it's generally still the motto and a central tenet of our investing strategy to find really high quality teams with high quality products and invest in them and let them effectively become satellites of Culligan rather than doing heavy integration, rather than sort of churning their teams and trying to drive out heavy synergies and have them become sort of part of a large corporate entity. You know, we really value those teams and in many cases their brands because they're often in places that have never heard of Culligan. We closed a transaction in Poland recently and, you know, the entrepreneur was critical to the deal. The brand, while small, was doing an excellent job in the Polish high-end office market and so on down the line, frankly. We do now, as we own some larger businesses, Quench comes to mind, where they'll do asset deals and they'll buy out contracts and just add them to their root density for service. And that works well. But yeah, I mean, I think we do face some of the similar challenges of keeping a team together and maintaining sort of the nucleus of what's good in a business. But I'd like to think, and I think our track record speaks to it, that generally we're finding companies and owners that are happy with what they're doing. They're excited about what they're doing. And if they want a change, when the big foam check, you know, sort of the Tiger Woods check lands on their doorstep, we'll discuss that before we get to that stage and put plans in place.
Very cool. Charlie, a lot of our listeners, you know, would probably love to get into corp dev. It's a really interesting area to work in. You know, what are some key skills kind of that you need to get a job in corp dev? And what are common career paths that you see to get into corporate development, you know, just as far as, you know, the folks that are on your team and that you work around?
Yeah, you know, I think when we look to bring on a new candidate, and we've done it a few times, we're looking for folks with transactional experience, typically. At a boutique investment bank or a bigger shop, or a time principal investing with a private equity fund at a sponsor, but it gets wider than that. Certainly, one member of our team did have some experience in a finance sort of FPA role at a mid-sized company. Didn't have a whole lot of direct M&A experience, but had a lot of exposure to a transaction that took place at that firm, and so felt that and had some chops from early career work, you know, maybe a year or two at an investment bank. So clearly had the sort of financial modeling experience or exposure to jump in. But I think, you know, if you look at my background, you know, I come at it from a fairly different angle. Yes, I did work at a PE fund of sorts. It was, you know, $300 million in assets under management. But, you know, really I came at it from trying to operate, you know, acquire and operate a really small, you know, pushing, struggling to hit $10 million in revenue business. And, you know, and landed here. So they're pretty diverse, pathways to get to corp dev.
Charlie, thank you for being on the podcast today. I think it's pretty interesting to hear, you know, some of your perspectives and how things may be different than a lot of the software companies that we talk about. For those of you listening to the podcast, if you have topics you'd like us to cover, if you have guests you'd like us to have on, you can send those to podcast@pjc.bc. We hope you check out the rest of our episodes, and we hope you have a good week and enjoy listening to the podcast. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the Uncovered Podcast. To learn more about PJC and the Uncovered Podcast, visit us at www.pjc.vc or email us at podcast@pjc.vc.